Morning. So this morning I want to talk about humor in Buddhism. And I want to contrast two different attitudes toward humor. One where it's encouraged and its virtues are extolled, and one in which it's discouraged. And maybe there's some resolution between the two. Maybe not. The first one, early Buddhism. Vinaya are the rules of behavior for monks and nuns in early Buddhism. The Nikayas, the early Pali scriptures, which are considered to be the first written testimonies to what the historical Buddha said, and Buddha himself, according to the Nikayas. So. The Vinayas say, the rules of behavior say, laughing out loud is an offense requiring confession and expiation in front of, how many? In front of fellow monastics. How many? Confession and expiation. The Nikayas call laughter which shows the teeth childish. And the Indian Buddhist teacher in the 4th century categorized different types of laughter and humor into the acceptable and the totally non-acceptable. And the acceptable is the serene smile of the Buddha and the serene smile of all you guys when you're just had a wonderful sit, but you don't show your teeth because you're just calm. You're just calm. You're not bragging. You're not putting anything out there. You're just calm, according to this. And then that's the first type. And the sixth type, the worst type, is the belly laugh, the raucous laughter. And when the Nikayas, and this includes the Dhammapada in early Buddhism. We're studying the Dhammapada starting next week. I hope you will join us. It's wonderful. It's early Buddhism. And it's early Buddhism as passed on in the Theravadan tradition to modern day. So we shouldn't make light of this stuff. There's something here for us because we do a practice similar to what the early Buddhists do in some sense. But we can also make light of it because we're Zen. If we can make light of ourselves, we can make light of it. But we better start with ourselves, right? So, according to the Nikayas, Buddha laughed and showed a lot of humor and laughed before what? Before he saw old age, sickness, and death, and for the rest of his life. For all of his practice and his great enlightenment and his teaching, he didn't laugh because he felt he had nothing to laugh about. He wanted to show people how to go beyond their base senses and their attachment to their base senses. And this requires seriousness. This requires serious questing, serious looking in. Hi, you don't have to sit on the floor. There are cushions in here, and there's a chair, and you can just come on in. So that's the synopsis, a very brief synopsis of the first attitude. The second attitude is the Chan attitude, which becomes the Zen attitude, right? Several hundred years later, we have Putai, or or Hoke, who's when he's portrayed in the Chinese paintings and then later in the Japanese, sometimes it's just one brushstroke. That brushstroke is a smile. Then often there's a second brushstroke, and the second brushstroke is the bag that he's carrying, a bag full of oranges, which he's passing out to everybody. So he's the jolly sage who doesn't even know he's a sage, who just passes out oranges. That's his practice, to pass out oranges. And we have the story of the three laughing monks. Again, if you look at some of the old Chinese Zen paintings, you see the story of the three laughing monks double over in that sixth form of laughter, that verboten form of laughter. And what are they laughing about? Well, if you see the picture there, three of them are laughing, and then there's a river going by them, and then there's a little island. Well, the story goes like this, that one of the three monks had made a vow to stay on that island and practice for his life, not to get involved in things, to be really serious about his practice. And these two friends come to visit him, because he's allowed to have friends. And as he's saying goodbye to them, they're so involved in conversation and being with each other that the first thing they know, they've crossed the bridge to the mainland. And then they all burst out in laughter. And then supposedly he goes back to the island. They crossed the bridge to see him. They hung out with him. Then he bid them goodbye, and he escorted them to cross the bridge. But he got so absorbed in being there with them, with their conversation and his love for them and the river, that he crossed the bridge to the other side, which he had vowed never to do in his whole life. And then the three of them burst out laughing when they discovered what he'd done. So, Zen is full of stories like this. I've been talking about the great Zen master Jiaozhou Joshu lately, who lived to be 119 and started his practice at 18 and had his enlightenment experience in his 20s and stayed with his teacher till he was 60 and didn't start teaching till he was 60. And he's known for the profundity of his teaching, the depth of his teaching, the seriousness of his teaching. But here's an exchange which you guys may have read about. Jiaozhou says to Wenyan, these are two teachers. This must have been when he was more than 62, when he said this, or more than 60. Jiaozhou says, "I am a donkey." You know where this is going? Wenyan says, "I'm its butt." Jiaozhou says, "I'm its turd." "I'm the turd." Wenyan says, "I'm a worm in the turd." Jiaozhou says, "What are you doing there?" Wenyan says, "I'm on vacation." And Wenyan is declared the winner by all the monks and nuns. The winner. This is the worst kind of laughter, according to early Buddhism and Theravada all the way through. So then there's the story of the teacher who was getting ready to die. Again, these are Chan stories. These are Chinese stories. You find actually many more of these in China than in Japan. So the teacher is named Tenyin Fing. He lives in the 8th century, and he's getting ready to die. And he says, well, he wants to die in a position that nobody knows Zen teachers haven't died in before. And the monks come back and say, well, no Zen teacher has ever died standing on his head. So, he dies standing on his head. Then an anonymous nun, these anonymous nuns are all over the place, an anonymous nun comes up, hears that he's died, and comes to pay reverence to him and sees that he's standing on his head dead. And she says, when you were alive, you took no notice of laws and customs, And even now that you're dead, you're making a nuisance of yourself. And she pokes him and he falls over. Well, that's another example. So, back to the contrasting and comparing the two a little bit. I want to do that now. So we can say that the first, the Vinaya, the Dhammapada, the Theravadin approach, is really emphasizing this is for monastics. This is for monastics. People who really, mon means one, really want to come back to that oneness beyond the samsaric world, to that oneness that's always here. So they're very, very serious. They're very serious. And raucous laughter has to do generally with what? I read this. It's raucous laughter more often has to do with sex, food, and the toilet than anything else. Well, okay, sex, food, and the toilet. But if you really want to go beyond your all of your pettiness, all of the talkativeness and worrying and grossed out thoughts that you have, you have to be really serious about this practice. This practice of sitting. Practice of sitting here in the morning, even if you just do it one morning a week. Even if you just do it 20 minutes a week. And if you want to see something that's deep, beyond the samsaric world, the world that you create in your head, you have to be really pretty serious and pretty severe. So, like Bodhidharma was. We don't see any pictures of Bodhidharma grinning. And he's the first guy. He's the archetypal figure. Upstairs I have pictures in my office, as many of you know, of different teachers. Actually three different teachers. There's one picture of me and Norm Randolph standing with Katagiri Roshi. And this is the day we got ordained. And he's wearing a beautiful robe. But he looks like a prune. If you look at his face, he looks like a prune. He is really serious about this. This is not to get something or to get somewhere or to make progress. This is to go all the way in. All the way in. To a stillness. But it's not the stillness that you create in your mind. I'm not talking about that stillness. It has nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with the stillness you create in your mind or in your emotion. And so, when I used to see Katagiri Roshi in that way, I didn't feel like coming too close to him. And Suzuki Roshi either. But luckily then when they would get up here and talk, then I saw the other side. But why? What is this? This is because our life is short. Do you want to go beyond the samsaric world that you create or not? Do you want to or not? How much more time do you have in your busy life to fit in 20 minutes a day? 20 minutes a day? Give me a break. It's not very much if you're really serious. It's serious business. So I used to be intimidated by Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi because of their severity, especially in retreats. Because we are monastics, but our monasticism is the world. But it's retreats where we do the Theravadin practice. And it's morning and evening sitting where we do the Theravadin practice. If we don't do that, our Buddhism is not real Buddhism because we don't tap into anything deep. So I used to be intimidated by them, and then a few years ago people started saying, or somebody told me, they said, I've been intimidated by you. And I thought, me? Me? And this guy said, yeah, you should look at yourself when you're sitting in the Zendo. You should look at yourself when you're doing Kinyin. Oh, picked up that habit. But it's not a habit, you guys. Depends on what you really want to do in your life. Depends on what your priorities are. Do you really want? Do you believe, first of all, that there is a peace? that we can't ever understand. Do you believe that? Maybe you don't. But if you believe that there's a peace that can't be understood, but through still practice of meditation, boring in to just what is, can be experienced. If you believe that, then you'll probably get pretty serious. A couple of people have been telling me lately they've been reading The Three Pillars of Zen. And no, I haven't read The Three Pillars of Zen maybe 20 years. But as I remember it, not only does it describe, it's a little bit seductive because it describes wonderful experiences of enlightenment, but especially it describes the ardor, the vigor, the seriousness with which Philip Kaplow and also a woman who's practicing do their practice. So that's why that tradition, I think, has some validity. And another thing we can say about that tradition, which is our tradition, because some of us may not be Buddhists, but we have a Buddhist attitude. You don't really need to be a Buddhist. You don't need to be a Buddhist. What's that? I don't know what that is. Just do the practice. Better to do the practice and not be a Buddhist than be a Buddhist and not do the practice. I mean, that's the way the world is, right? I don't want Buddhists. I want people who practice. I want people who care about going all the way in to the stillness that never leaves you. It never leaves you. Even if you're completely depressed, it's there. It doesn't matter how many meds you're on for depression. It's there. It's here. You get discouraged because you think, oh, my. But no, it's here. You can do it. But the Dhammapada and the Vinaya and the Nikayas seem to be talking also about a certain kind of humor, especially, and that's the humor where you feel superior to someone else, to something, or even to your old self. Boy, now I've got it. Woohoo! You know, that kind of thing. Maybe you don't experience that, but if you stay with this practice long enough, you'll have some wonderful experiences, and then you'll think, now I've got it. But that's exactly what the Nikayas are talking about when they say, don't laugh. So in the Dhammapada, a woman laughs when a fellow starts taking pride in his accomplishments. And this woman actually was the woman behind his accomplishments, right? And she had actually saved his life. So she laughs. That's not okay, because she's using laughter as a way of distancing, as a way of feeling superior. So those are the first practice is telling us about our life, the one where no smile, well, maybe a little bit of smile, but no laughter. Just do it. People who are in training with me to become teachers here at Zen Center, I expect them to do at least 12 days of retreat a year, minimally. Why? Because we're monastics. And if we were in the doing a Theravada thing, we'd do 365 days. That would be our life. If you don't at least do 12 days, you don't have a chance to discover the ineffable. You don't have it. It's impossible. It's impossible. So back to the Zen one. Now that you're all looking prune-faced, good. I want some more prune-faced behavior out here. No, I don't. She says I don't. Okay. The second one, Zen humor is based on the release that happens generally when we mindfully see incongruity between what's in our minds, the picture of the world, our ideal, our memory, and what's going on out here. Whenever we see that incongruity and can just see it, not criticize it, we release. We release. We open up. Well, for instance, the Chaucho and the turds. That's a pretty good example. And there are in Zen humor, I think there are, you don't have to really, you take this with a grain of salt, but I think there are three different ways in which we can see humor manifesting itself. One is for reversing and collapsing our categories, that we carry around in our head, right? Reversing and collapsing. That turd story reverses and collapses, doesn't it? I mean, who's holy around here? What's holy? Where's the altar? It's the worm. And where's that worm living? Well, we won't go over this again because you guys have it. Got it down yet? So the virtuous. Oh, yes, my practice is getting better. Well, maybe so. My altar here is really, I take care of my altar. But where's the world? If your altar is here, separate from the world, then pay attention to the worm in the feces, in the shit. So don't divide it up that way. And then when you see that you're dividing up that way, then you can just laugh about it, right? If you laugh about it, you won't put yourself down. You just see it. Just see it. You won't put yourself down because it's rather marvelous, rather very incongruous and rather marvelous that we as human beings do that, that our picture always hypnotizes us. And well, I've talked before about how we need that picture to have a sense of progress, but still it hypnotizes us. So, a couple more stories about this. This the first type, reversing and collapsing categories. The first one is teacher was getting ready to die, again, this is Chan. This is Chinese Zen. Teacher's getting ready to die, and is monks, maybe nuns too, are all around him, and they're waiting for his last words. I don't know why the stories all go the monks being around him waiting for his last words, but they seem to all go like that. And he says, "Truth is like a river," on his deathbed. But then he doesn't die right away. He hangs on for about a week. And the monks and nuns are all reflecting on truth is like a river, really bringing it into their zazen seriously, noticing the river of their minds as it floats on, not getting attached to it, but still not getting really the meaning of what he says in the way they want to. Because the way we want to is to break beyond our picture in our heads. So, but he doesn't die right away. He's still barely alive a week later. So one of them comes back to him and he says, "Well, teacher, we've been reflecting on this, and some of us don't really understand the meaning of the truth is like a river. We don't really understand that meaning." And he said, "Okay, truth is not like a river." And then he dies. You can find this in the Chan records. I didn't make it up. So, you know, the story about the monk asking Sozan, "What's the most precious thing in the world?" And Sozan says, "A dead cat, because nobody can put any value on it." Because nobody can put any value on it. So, I'm going to tell two or three stories today that many of you have heard before, from me being with Suzuki Roshi. This first one is about reversing and collapsing categories, is my last example. So I was with my first teacher, and we were driving down to the monastery in California, Tassajara Zen Monastery. And we were going to start a practice period, and it was just me and him in the car. And it was about a three-hour drive from San Francisco to Carmel Valley. And halfway through, he wanted to stop for coffee. He said, let's stop for coffee. Some of you remember this story pretty well. You could tell it yourself. And I thought, God, in the first place, I don't drink coffee. I know I didn't then. And in the second place, it was only like a 2.5 hour drive. Why do we have to, maybe only an hour and a half? I don't know. Why do we have to? But he wanted to stop for coffee. So I thought, okay, well, I got to stop for coffee. So we stopped for coffee at this little cafe. And we went in. And he ordered coffee, and I said, would you have any herb tea? Of course, they didn't even know what herb tea. They said, well, all our tea's herb tea. They didn't know. This was a long time ago, right? So, okay, I'll have water. So then he saw at the table next to him, someone was eating something that looked very interesting to him. And he said to me, what's that? And I said, that's a banana split. And he said, oh, I want one of those. So, we ordered him a banana. I was in my water. He was with coffee. He ordered his banana split. It came. He looked at it. He looked at the chocolate, the strawberry, the vanilla, kind of touched it with his spoon, the whipped cream, the cherries, the nuts, chocolate sauce, strawberry sauce. He said, oh, just like America. Everything mixed together. Okay. I guess it was like America, everything mixed together. I know the Japanese would never do that. They have a little chocolate here, a little strawberry here. And you couldn't put the strawberry with the chocolate, and then they have the sauce separately. Okay. But he wasn't putting it down. Okay. I'm sticking with my water. You have the banana split and the coffee. I'm going down to do practice period. I've been purifying my system for a while. It's kind of scary going into practice period. We're living down there, I want to be pretty clear. So he takes a little bite of the chocolate, the vanilla, the strawberry. And then he said, I've had enough. You finish it. And he gives it to me. And what's a poor boy to do? What's a poor young man to do? Who loves chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla? I got a stomachache afterwards. I showed up at Tassajara with a bad stomachache to start my practice period. poor Tim. So the teaching reverses and collapses our categories. And you may not like it, but ultimately, when you see it, when you experience it all the way, it's great humor, great laughter. When they're really collapsed. Now, when they're collapsing, you hate it. But once they're collapsed, hee-hee. And, of course, they are never finally collapsed. That's a myth some Rinzai teachers have, that it's finally collapsed. Yeah, right. Find me one of those. Because we always are creating things. We always are creating more ideas about what should be. Who should be, how I should be, how someone else should be. And the second one is embracing opposites, the second form of Zen laughter, embracing opposites. We have the Chinese dragon spitting fire in one caption. In the next caption, the Chinese dragon has a huge grin on its face. We have the serene Buddha in one caption. In the next caption, he's rolling on the floor with laughter. Embracing opposites. In our culture, I love Laurel and Hardy. Laurel and Hardy, my favorite. And I like Charlie Chaplin pretty well, too, but I just haven't seen as much of Charlie Chaplin. But what about Charlie Chaplin? Charlie Chaplin has a perfect bowler hat. He's got a cane that has been purchased in London at some fancy store. He's got a nice coat, tailor-made, probably costs $1,000. And he's got enormously baggy pants and shoes that don't match with holes in them. And collapsing or embracing opposites. Embracing opposites, not collapsing, embracing them. And this comes from our mindfulness meditation. We begin to embrace them. We begin to see that they're as I said in my last talk, that we're finally, Beauty and the Beast marry each other. Finally they marry. The Beast is still the Beast, and Beauty is still Beauty. But they're married. They're married. It takes a lot of patience for you to experience this and then for you to live it in your Zen life, in your daily life. So I'm embracing opposites. Suzuki Roshi story. So I'm going to tell three today. embracing opposites. So another time I had been practicing at Tassajara Zen Monastery for a while, and I had the kind of enlightenment experience that's described in Philip Kaplow's book. If any of you go back and read it, you'll see it described. Then I left the monastery and went home to see my mother with my wife. And then I came back to Tassajara, and Suzuki Roshi called me into his little room, and he said, "Your mother called me." I thought, "My mother called him? My God." She's still. How old am I? But, you know, she was my mother, right? "Your mother called me." He said, "I'm going to visit with her." I thought, "Oh, no." I never get away. I mean, that's a whole different story, right? And he said, "Yes, I think maybe she is surprised." And I said, "Oh, surprised?" He said, "Yes, because the ugly duckling has turned into a swan." And I went, "Oh." I didn't say anything. Then he looked at me and he said, "Or maybe the swan has turned into an ugly duckling." Embracing opposites. I couldn't embrace the opposites at that moment. I couldn't. When he said swan, I thought, "Ooh." When he said ugly duckling, I thought, "Oh, God." Oh, no. Enough of this Zen stuff. Or something. Or something. And the third type of Zen humor is the type which is just an expression of the mind which is not burdened by thought. Not burdened by thought. Even for a moment, if you're not burdened by your thinking, you'll see the humor in life. You'll see the humor in your interchanges. You won't necessarily laugh raucously, but you could. You could. So there's the story, speaking of raucous laughter, of the monk who lives on the hill, and the people in the village have trouble sleeping at night because the monk laughs so loud at the moon that they can't go to sleep. So one of the people in the village goes up to visit him, and the monk invites the person to sit in meditation with him, and he sits in meditation with him for a week. And then at the end of the week, they're both laughing at the moon. Well, the story goes on and on. But and upstairs, I have the Katagiri picture where he is looking like a prune face, where he's got me and Norm. You can't blame him, can you? You know, maybe you don't know us, but if you know us, you wouldn't blame him. What have I done? What have I done? Are they going to be as serious about this as I was? Are they going to? Are you going to be as serious about it as Katagiri Roshi? On the other hand, I have a picture on my altar of him where his grin is so big, you can't even see his eyes. You can't see anything. Well, you see his bald head. His bald head and his grin. So, third Suzuki Roshi story, which I probably have not told for a year or two. I don't know. Some of you could remember better than me, probably. So we were having, my wife and I, we were having Suzuki Roshi over to dinner with my grandmother, who was a Catholic, and my mentor. She's one of my mentors, definitely. Linda was cooking, and we had this little black kitten. And my grandmother, Suzuki Roshi, me, my wife, and the little black kitten. I think I was probably married by then. And Suzuki Roshi sits down. He's dressed in black. And the black kitten starts batting at the sash on his robe and on where his robe is hanging down. And Suzuki Roshi starts batting back at the kitten. The kitten bats some more, and Suzuki Roshi bats some more. And pretty soon they're engaged in this incredible batting play, black on black. Well, I don't even think they know it's what color. My grandmother is just sitting looking at them. And afterwards, it's time for dinner, and Suzuki Roshi stops, and we get up and we have dinner. And Suzuki Roshi goes home. And then a couple days later, Suzuki Roshi doesn't ask me about my grandmother. He asks me about the cat. He said, that cat was fun. And my grandmother says to me, for a year afterwards, she said, and that priest and that laughing. She said, he was a priest, wasn't he? And I said, yes, Grandma, he is a priest. And she'd come back the next month. That man... Did you say he was a priest? And I said, yes, he is a priest, Grandma. But Grandma didn't get it. Grandma didn't get it. But she tried to get it. She did her best to get it. She was really supportive of me in my practice. Really supportive. She just didn't... She didn't have any priests who did that kind of thing. So, this practice, these two together... Are what Zen's about, what our life's about, and the more that we practice the zazen, the more we'll be able to just see the categories collapse, and enjoy their collapse. We'll be able to embrace the opposites. We'll be able to play with the cats and the dogs that come up and lick our faces or don't lick our faces. And enjoy some pretty simple things. So, I think that's it. I guess that's it. For me, how about for you guys? How about for you? Questions, comments? Maybe you can outgross me in terms of my story. I did my best.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Is that he retained a childlike quality, playing with the cat, banana split.
Mm-hmm.
He retained that childlike quality, which is golden.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I think that's right. And it's, could you guys hear it, James? Yeah, we could say retained, or we can say rediscovered. That he had rediscovered the ability just to be here. Just to be here. Without anything about before or after. And that is a childlike quality, we say. But it's also the quality that is our innate quality. All we have to do is come back to being here. Completely. Completely. Thank you. Thank you. Other people. Yeah. Uh-huh. Hmm. Yep, okay. Do you want to say something more about that?
No, but I would imagine that seriousness doesn't necessarily equal feeling depressed or bummed out.
Oh, I would hope so. I would hope so. When we're talking about seriousness in Buddhism, we're not talking about cultivating depression or being bummed out. We are not talking about that. We're talking about doing what Shakyamuni did, which is to seriously consider the suffering that we bring on people and the world, and to make a vow, which we continually repeat to ourselves moment after moment, to discover something deeper, something which is free from suffering, and to help other people discover that. And that's the seriousness. So right in the middle of depression, I mean, you can have... You can have different types of depression, many different experiences of depression, but right in the middle of that, if you get serious about this path and you see yourself on this path and you do it, then that seriousness actually lightens your depression because you have something that you really care about that you're doing. It really makes a difference to you. And your depression becomes really quite a bit lighter. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I just keep thinking about forgetting the self and how, for me, that's so central to humor. What humor constantly offers me the opportunity of is that the only way that I get a really good belly laugh going is because I think I probably look a little bit foolish when I'm like that. At least some people tell me that I look a little foolish when I'm laughing and being goofy in situations like that. But it's a forgetting of the self, and I think that it's that crying is like that also. There's a way to cry that is a forgetting of the self. There's a way to laugh that's a forgetting of the self. And I don't know how to make those clear distinctions, but I know it when I'm in it. I know it when I'm not in it. I just let it go. And I'm so grateful for that. Those moments when they come. And I don't know that I can make those things happen, but I suspect that there's ways in which I can open myself to them.
I suspect so too. I more than suspect so. Good. Thank you. Yes, crying too. I mean, people do during retreats sometimes cry, and sometimes they cry about personal stuff, which is fine. But sometimes something happens, and all of a sudden everything is open, and they have some gratitude that just. They don't know where it comes from. It just, tears are coming out. Just a couple of tears is enough for you to realize how precious this practice is, because it has no value. It has no value at all. It's really precious.
So here's a complicated question. So, Bush talked about going to do some kind of study at the U. They wanted to do a study with him and interview him and stuff. And
can you guys hear her?
Roshi went to the U for a study that they wanted to do with him and interview him. And so they asked him, what's your favorite TV show? Some of you heard. And he said, The Love Boat.
Thank you.
They're all kind of looking at him like, huh? And they say, well, why? Why do you like The Love Boat? And he said, because everybody leaves The Love Boat.
Oh. Anything else? Yeah.
If you're in touch with how painful the things that you do are, then why would you be compelled to stop them?
If you are in touch with how painful things that you do are, won't you be compelled to stop doing those things? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes.
If you're really in touch with that.
Yes, you will. And that's the mindfulness that we bring into our meditation. If we can just recognize, just see it, and I talk about this all the time, but not to you. If we can just see it, just recognize it without criticizing it, and then restrain ourselves from acting on it, then we can relax. And when we relax, it's gone. It's gone. Something else is going to come back, but it's gone.
So yeah. Wouldn't the seriousness be a byproduct of getting in touch with how painful?
Yes, but the point is that to really get to, wouldn't the serious, so you hear what she said, wouldn't the seriousness be a byproduct of getting in touch with the painful? Well, it could be. For instance, Buddha, after he saw the pain of the sickness, old age, and death, he became really serious. It was a byproduct for him, and it changed the course of his whole life. But what else could have he done? He could have gone to the nearest bar. He could have gone to the nearest brothel. He could have done both one and then the other. He could have said, well, whatever. But he didn't. He didn't.
Why was that painful for him, seeing sickness and old age?
Because he was shaken. He was shaken when he saw the corpses burning on the funeral pyre.
Because he knew that was going to happen.
Yep. And that happened to that happens to all of us. And here he was, already 28 years old. He was a wealthy prince who had a child, who had all of the support he wanted. But it felt kind of shallow to him. And here he saw this person really suffering, and then he saw all these bodies burning on the funeral pyre, and it shook him to the core. And after that, he saw the sannyasin, who seemed to be. That was the fourth thing he saw, beatific. And he thought, oh, well, I'm going to get serious about this world, this life.
Was it painful for him because he felt bad for the other person, or because he felt bad for himself that he was going to lose what he had?
Well, you know, I'm not Buddha, so I'm not the historical Buddha. I am Buddha, so are you. We're all Buddha, right? I would say both. I would say that both his own life, but also empathy. Because if you don't have empathy, this practice becomes very dried out. It's a new project that you've got to reform yourself. And that's okay, but the empathy has to be there, even early on, for you to sustain it.
So seeing suffering in someone else.
Uh-huh. Right, that's right.
But why did he have to suffer seeing suffering in someone else?
Because why did he have to suffer when he saw the suffering? If he'd been sociopathic or psychopathic, he would not have suffered, because that's what, or narcissistic, because sociopathic, psychopathic, narcissistic people don't suffer when they see someone else. But those of us who don't have that kind of diagnosis, and I hope none of us do, or some of us may, you don't know, we empathize. Luckily, we empathize when we feel someone's, when we see someone suffering. Luckily.
Is that suffering, or is that just the thought that the object of sitting was to not suffer anymore?
Oh, that would be great, but... Yes, suffering is different from pain. Uh-huh. Pain is just physical. Suffering is what we do with pain. And if we can just be with pain, that's not dukkha in the Buddhist sense. Dukkha for suffering is really the dissatisfaction that we have about pain, our pain or someone else's, instead of just being with it, that we cling to the dissatisfaction. Well, that's a whole other talk. The whole other talk. Okay?
I have more questions, but I'll shut up.
Well, you can talk to me afterwards, or come back next Sunday. Yeah?
The crosswalk out in front of the building here.
Yeah?
Cars are not very serious about coming to a full stop. You know,
yeah. You could say what?
Their practice of stopping
is a little shoddy at the stop sign. Uh-huh.
If you watch it, if you even watch a police car kind of roll through,
yeah,
not doing a full stop, you appreciate that everybody's practicing all the same, so that when I step out of the crosswalk, you, cars stop.
Uh-huh.
And my safe crossing is assured.
Uh-huh. That's right. That's right.
But you know, you get very, very familiar.
That's right.
With practice, and so that, somebody's in a crosswalk, but then you know precisely what to do to come to a full stop.
That's right. Good, I like that. I like that analogy. Thank you. So kind of what he's saying reminds me of the fact that we develop sitting routines. And we develop routines of sitting every day and of doing retreats. And while we're doing that, sometimes we're not so serious. But the very fact that we get our butt on the cushion again, as we did 3 days before, means that there's a potential for seriousness. It's the potential is there. We're developing a habit which creates the potential for seriousness. And when we really then go into a real concentrated state, we maintain that seriously. So it's not like we need to come into the Zendo and have a new mantra is, I should be serious about this sitting. Because if we do that, then that's a new category. My point more is that in the 21st century, the way we do Buddhism in the United States, the way I do Buddhism, is that we have all of the stimulation, all of the stuff going on outside that we're trying to deal with, jobs, with family, with relationships. In contrast to these folks in the Nikayas and the Agamas and the Dhammapada. So we had better get seriously about that little time that we spend. 12 days a year is nothing to spend in retreat. Nothing. Or we won't have a chance of tasting this wonderful fruit that has been laid out for us by our teachers and our friends. But I think you weren't disagreeing with that, were you?
Yeah. So as we remember to open to emptiness or seek emptiness, mm-hmm. and with that, seriousness is that sort of a byproduct then of being open to the emptiness.
Yeah. I would say you could call it a byproduct of being open to emptiness.
Not me. I don't seek seriousness.
Right.
I'm not a serious person.
Right. Well, you don't have to be a serious person. What's a serious person? Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Hi.
So, just to make sure, if I have to digress for a second. So, in Buddhism in general, since I practice on a semi-regular basis.
Since you what?
Since I practice on a semi-regular basis.
Okay.
Sorry about my English at all. But, so seriousness in Buddhism is both diligence and practice. It has nothing to do with necessarily pain or suffering or fanaticism. It just involves diligence.
That's right. Seriousness is just seriousness. I mean, it's whatever happens, we just stay with it. We don't flirt with it. If we flirt with it, immediately it turns into something. We don't push it aside and say it's bad. You may say that's serious, but that's not the kind of seriousness we're talking about. Because that very, oh, this is no good, that's not really serious. Really serious is to just completely see it and not indulge it and not repress it. Just completely see it. And then it loses its power. Okay. Thank you.